this program, couldn't quite get a grasp of it. But I was lucky enough to attend a AA roundup in September of 94, and there was a speaker there that night that I'd never heard of, and he explained the program in such a manner that I could really relate to it, and in fact it made a big impact upon me. And if you've attended the hospital group, especially the 6 o'clock meeting, you've probably been given a copy of that, a tape of that talk he gave that night, or perhaps even a 12-step study, because we've tried to distribute a lot of them. Anyway, it's a great privilege and honor to welcome Don M. from Louisville.
Thank you, Rod. Hi, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm real grateful to be here. Gosh, I don't feel like I'm very, very far from home. I've got at least two sets of folks from home that are here, and a lot of you guys that I've met before and real glad to see again. So I guess I'll have to try to be honest. Too many people here know the truth for me to get very fancy tonight. So I guess I'll just have to try to do what's always so hard, and that's just be simple and honest about the whole thing. And if I let God get me out of the way, and it's real important to me that I say that rather than if I can get myself out of the way. I said that for years. Before I would start an AA talk, I would say, if I can get myself out of the way. Let me tell you something, folks. If I could get me out of the way, I wouldn't even need to be here. Getting me out of the way has always been too big a job for me, and it's no less too big a job for me today than it was the last day I drank. I simply cannot get me out of the way. I've got to have God's help to get me out of the way. So if I let God do that, as I read the directions and the instructions, and believe it or not, I do try to follow the directions and instructions today, and that's a miracle. But as I read them, I need to share with you folks in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And another thing that's gotten really important to me here recently is, you know, that book says that our personal stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our God. And it's just real important to me that my story carries that message because, see, when I first started coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the mention of God or higher power absolutely made those little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. It just made me mad that anybody would talk about such claptrap in front of an intellectual giant like myself. That ran me out of AA a number of times, but I found out a great truth. I found out that if you've got wrong with you, what I've got wrong with me, there's really not anywhere else to go, and if you're lucky enough to live, booze will run you back if the mention of God and higher power runs you off. So I hope anybody that's new that my talking about that doesn't turn you off, but if it does, I'm really sorry, but I sure understand. But please stick with it because the same kind of miracle might happen for you as has happened for myself and for so many of us. You see, I didn't get to AA because alcohol gave me the hiccups. I wrote it down pretty far. I lost most things that a human being can lose except my physical life itself. And I used every human power that I could find to try to do something about my alcoholism. And it wasn't a matter that those human powers weren't quite enough to do the trick. They didn't seem to have any impact on it at all. Those human powers just seemed to bounce right off my alcoholism. And it wasn't until loving God that I didn't even know was there as far as having anything to do with my life led me to you guys, and you guys took me by the hand and led me through these 12 steps that are the only program of recovery that there is, the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those steps led me back to that loving God that I was able to live. So it's real important to me that my message does carry that, does carry how I've been able to. And really, I don't think I formed the relationship. I think you guys just taught me how to stop, and these steps put me in a position where God formed the relationship. I don't think I'm even capable of doing that. But at any rate, my body grew up on a tobacco, and thank you all for inviting me. I just love to come down to northern Alabama, and you've got a great brand of AA here, and it just makes me feel really good that you guys wanted me to be with you this weekend. So thanks for inviting me. Everybody's been just sweet as they can be. Ron and Monica are just great host and hostess, and everything is as it should be. But my body grew up on a tobacco farm up in southwestern Kentucky, and the rest of me is kind of growing up and growing old at the same time, I guess. And before I got sober, I was really sincere in that I believed that I had about the most interesting and romantic story about my rise to power from the depths of poverty that you have ever heard of in your life. And, of course, it was all about how I had picked myself up by the bootstraps and by my iron will and my sterling intellect had lifted myself out of the depths of poverty to those staggering heights that I'd reached. And I meant every word of it. I would usually get you and me both crying before I got halfway done with it. And I wasn't sober a month before I realized that that was all a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't even really close to poor. We were middle-class farming people who had everything we needed and a lot of the things that we wanted. And you can bet that those heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. I've had to be real careful all my life about being a legend in my own mind. Looking back on my childhood, I don't know whether you can be an alcoholic before you ever take a drink of alcohol or not, and I no longer really care. I used to be so interested in all those things, all these intellectual details and so on, and I wouldn't walk across the street if somebody had all those answers. They no longer make much difference to me because I've got the solution. But I have an idea that you got to drink alcohol to be an alcoholic. But as far as what's basically wrong with me, the book's real clear about that. It says where it talks about the third step, that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think was the root of our troubles. And as far back as I can remember, that's what's been there. The first 11 or 12 or 13 years of my life, that really, I think, is the only thing important that was going on. You see, my first sponsor told me that what that really means, that selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my troubles, he told me that what that really means is that the first thing wrong with me is I've got a disorder of my ego, and that everything else has flowed from that. The physical allergy to alcohol, the mental obsession, all the sicknesses of mind, body, and spirit have all flowed from that disorder of my ego. And he explained that on account of that disorder of my ego, that all my life I've been so obsessed with myself, so obsessed with how I feel, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people, that all that obsession with myself has created so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me that I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can or stuffing something in there to try to do something about all that emptiness and pain that that obsession with myself has created. And that's what the first 12, 13 years of my life were. All my life I've been an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is real simple. I've always been real capable of feeling too good for something and not nearly good enough for the same thing at the same time. Too smart for something and too dumb for that same thing at the same time. Now add to that, for whatever reason, in sort of a sick sort of way, I've always been terribly ambitious and real lazy at the same time. Now, you get all that conflict going inside a kid, and you got a mess going on. And every time one of those spontaneous flyover gut checks would happen, you know, I wouldn't be intending, I don't think, to ask, hey, Don, how you doing down there? But it just happened. You know, I wasn't expecting me. I wasn't looking for me, but I'd turn around, and there I was. And the question would get asked, hey, Don, how you doing down there? And it'd be a real uproar. It'd be, hey, boy, don't be looking down here, and don't be asking that. Because you can't stand seeing what's here and what's missing down here. You keep moving. Do that cute and smart deal of yours. And if you can't get that to fly, then just create a negative disturbance. But do whatever's necessary to keep anybody from drawing a bead on you and seeing what's wrong with you. Because I guess a part of me always knew that if you saw what I was and what I wasn't, that I might have to stop and look at that. And a part of me knew that I couldn't stand that. It'd be like the earth would swallow me up through that emptiness in my own midsection. And that's pretty well the way I made it through the first 12, 13 years of my life, trying to stay a half step ahead of a screaming fit. And truth is, the screaming fit would catch me with some regularity, but I stayed ahead of it most of the time. Another couple of things about what I was like, I believe on account of that same ego disorder, which is my illness. When I talk about my ego disorder, I'm talking about my alcoholism. I believe on account of that same ego disorder that I was never able to give any consideration to the possibility that there might be a power greater than myself that had anything to do with running my life on a daily basis. Now, I was pretty well okay with some sort of intellectual theory about a creative intelligence or something like that, But when it got down to what I believe my religious friends today call the idea of a personal God, the idea that there was some power out there that was more important than my little old brain, as far as actually running every minute of every hour of every day of my life, my ego vetoed that big time. And I wasn't able to give any consideration till I got sober. And by the way, my sobriety date is April the 9th, 1981. And I was 37 years old when I got sober, and that makes me 56 now, so you don't have to do the math. But for that first 37 years, I wasn't able to consider that. And also for that first 37 years, I honestly don't believe that I had any teachability or humility whatsoever. Now, of course, I could learn things from books, and I could learn some things about life, but the reason I don't believe I had any teachability or humility is I've never been able to remember a single time in that 37 years that I voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And, you know, it doesn't bother me that I felt that way for 37 years, but it kind of bugs me that that still sounds pretty good right now. You know, after all, why in the world should I? I'm going to tell you in a minute how crazy I am, but there's a difference in crazy and stupid. So why in the world should I do something about my life if I don't understand it or I don't agree with it or I don't think it'll work? Well, when I get honest, it's real, real simple. You see, as far as I know, I've got the world's only talking illness. I don't know of any other illness that talks to you all the time except alcoholism. And it's been running its mouth ever since I can remember. And I don't think it ever tried to kill me because I don't think it cares whether I live or die. I don't think it gives a hoot. I think the only priority it's got is trying to get a drink. And it'll tell me anything in this world to try to get that drink. It'll tell me something that will kill me. It'll tell me something that'll kill you. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever missing a stitch. It just slings it all up against the wall hoping some of it'll stick. And that would be fine if I could always just listen to that illness, my brain talking to me, and say, oh, well, that's just my illness talking to me. I'll go to a meeting, pray a little bit, and call old John on the phone and read the big book and do the next right thing. That'll be fine. But see, I got another problem. If my alcoholism is anything at all, it is a disease of perception. And what that means is even simpler. I don't see things right. I don't hear them right. I don't recognize them for what they are all the time. And the bottom line is, if I'm going to put that ultimate veto power in the universe in my brain, and of course name it common sense because that's what it always feels like, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it, I agree with it, and I think it'll work, I'll wind up one day believing one of those deadly lies that my illness tells me, and I'll pick up that drink and I'll die. And that's why I've got to be here. That's why I can't live on just the program. That's why I can't lock myself up in a room with a big book and my higher power and meditate and levitate and stay sober and half sane. Because I've got to have the fellowship. Because, you know, those insane ideas, man, that dress themselves up as common sense, and they always do. I've never had an insane idea walk up and say, good morning, Don, I'm a crazy idea, and I'm here to try to kill you today. No, because if it walked up and announced itself that way, I'd step around that sucker. I probably wouldn't fool with it. So my insane ideas always come up the same way. They say, good morning, Don, how are you, buddy? I'm common sense. And they immediately start talking about how special I am and how different my circumstances are from everybody else's. And whatever it is that I know in my heart what the next right thing for me to do or not to do is, and my brain is assuring me that it'll be a disaster if I don't do the exact opposite, this insane idea dressed up like common sense will say, well, Don, if those other people in AA had all the pressures on them that you've got on you, why, they'd do it that way too. And then they'll tell me, well, you know, a lot of them probably doing it that way and just won't cop out to it. And then it really get me to say, wait a minute, you know, Don, you may not be looking at this right. This may not even be completely selfish. Look here, three or four times removed in kind of a left-handed way, that might help somebody. So you know you got to do that, partner. It's just common sense. And here's the magic. In 19 and a half years sober, not one single time has one of my insane ideas sounded like common sense to one of you guys. I don't care if you just got out of the asylum this morning. You knocked it out for me just like that, and I can do the same thing for you. And that's a big reason that I've got to have the fellowship. One more quick thing about what I was like. It was always my ambition to be an alcoholic. That's what I wanted to grow up to be. But of course, I didn't know that until I'd been sober about a year. But looking back on it, it's very clear. See, by the time I was 4 or 5, I got to looking around at the decent, responsible, hardworking men in the farming community where I grew up. And what I saw was the dullest bunch of old dudes you ever saw in your life. Lord, they'd wear those old overalls and stuff and drive those old beat-up, paid-for pickup trucks. And they'd usually be married to some lady that, even though I was just a little boy, they looked drab to me. Back then, on the farm, they'd wear those old dresses, looked like flour sacks. And more often than not, they'd have a whole house full of little snotty-nosed kids. And those guys would get up every morning of their life and eat breakfast with that drab-looking woman and all those kids and go get in that old beat-up, paid-for pickup truck and go right exactly where somebody had told them to go. And all day they would do what somebody told them to do. And what really blew me away was that at the end of the day, they'd come back to the same people they'd left that morning. And then they'd eat supper and go to bed with the chickens, get up the next day and do the same fool thing. And then maybe on Sunday, they'd load the whole crew in the pickup and go up the road to Julian Baptist Church or down the road to Locust Grove Baptist Church. And then on Sunday afternoon, they might do something like go visit people, for goodness sakes. And see, part of this ego disorder is that I have never in my life been able to have but one knee-jerk reaction to anything or anybody. Thank the good Lord, on account of this program, I don't always have to act on it today, but the only knee-jerk reaction on my own I've ever been able to have to anything or anybody is, what has this got to do with me? So I looked at those guys and made those observations and had the only reaction I could have. And it came to me, well, you're a little boy and they're grown men, so maybe when you grow up, your life will be something like that. Like scared me to death. It absolutely terrified me to think that any little thing in my life might be like those decent, responsible men. Now, my older brother Dan, who's 13 years older than I, did not cause my alcoholism. As far as I know, my family did not cause my alcoholism. I don't have any idea in the world what a dysfunctional family is. And the reason I don't is I have never met anybody who claimed that they came from a functional family. So until I can identify a functional family, I don't know what in the world a dysfunctional family is, but I'm pretty sure I was the most dysfunctional thing in my family. But by the time I was probably about 7 years old, I had aggravated Dan until he would occasionally take me over into the wet county where they had the beer joints and let me sit around and drink big oranges and eat pickled eggs while he drank beer. And, of course, I would observe and listen. And the first thing I observed was a lot of those honky-tonk heroes had those big flashy cars they couldn't pay for sitting in the parking lot. Then we'd walk on in, and I can remember to this night how cool those guys looked sitting at that bar. Lord, it knocked my socks off. They'd do stuff like gaze down into that beer, and it looked like they were lost in it. You know, they look in it, not bat an eye for an hour, you know, maybe turn that sucker around real slow and tap on it with a ring while they were plumbing its depths. And I could look at them, tell they were intelligent, deep, and romantic, and so much more interesting than those old drones out there on that farm. And then I'd look over in a booth and I'd see one of them with his arm draped around some lady that looked a lot more interesting to me than those old gals in those flour sack dresses. And these fellas didn't care if they were married to somebody else, and they didn't care if those women were married to somebody else. But the most magic thing of all, I didn't get to finish the first big orange until I had overheard enough conversations to know that nearly every one of those guys was only about that far from being rich and famous. Every one of them had at least one great big deal that was just about to pop, maybe were flat going to be somebody. Now, it was usually a good big deal, but not always, because the important word was big. If they had a bad deal, it was a big bad deal. You know, if they had some trouble with the law, they didn't have a little trouble with the law. They were going to the pen for longer than any SOB ever did, by God. Well, I was told the first week I was sober that what I've got's a disease of big deals. I was told, Don, your whole life's been one big deal right after another. Good big deals and bad big deals all stumbling and falling over one another. I said, that's no mystery. I said, on account of your fouled up ego, your ego disorder, anything that you can make by any stretch of your imagination have something to do with you, you blow up into a great big deal. Same thing happened to somebody else and it's not a big deal. And they went on to tell me that if I was ever going to have any comfortable sobriety, I was going to have to get to the point where I could at least act like that I believe that any time I make a big deal out of anything, anything, including my health, including my kids, including my sex relations, including my money, including my freedom, any time I make a big deal out of anything that is not God and not these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego and I'm back into alcoholism. And over the years, I found out that for me, that's exactly right. I don't need big deals in my life. Big deals are a sign of spiritual illness and spiritual mistakes in me. Now, I can't stop feeling like they're big deals, but you know, the great truth of that, I thought I made a big deal out of something or didn't make a big deal out of something by the way I felt about it, because that's at the heart of my illness, is this insane conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. You know what I found out? Whether I feel like it's a big deal doesn't make a bit of difference in the world. I make a big deal out of something or don't make a big deal out of it by the way I act. I can feel like it's the biggest deal in the world, but if I act like it's not a big deal, that'll work just fine, and first thing you know, I don't feel like it's such a big deal, and I can go on and act sanely. But I tell you, 50 years ago in those beer joints in that little town, Gracie, Kentucky, I sure didn't know there was anything wrong with big deals. And I heard those guys talking about all their big deals, and what happened was that I took my first good long look at self-will run riot, at total ego, at total disregard for honesty on any level, a total lack of consideration for other people, and I fell in love with everything about it. From the first time I got a real good look at those guys, I never had but one real ambition. I wanted to grow up to be just exactly like them, and I got my ambition. I just didn't know what the right name for it was. Well, I got drunk first time when I was either 12 or 13, and that first night I got in an awful lot of trouble, and I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover, and I swore all those Baptists around there were right and I would never do it again. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And it was nearly a week before I got drunk the second time. Because you see, the magic had happened, and I didn't know the magic had happened. At the time, all I knew was that for a few minutes on my way to puking and getting in all that trouble, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But looking back on it, I know it was the magic. When I got enough of that stuff in me that for the first time it did something about that pain and that emptiness that obsession with myself had created all my life, for the next 25 years, since the way I felt had always been and remained the most important thing in the world to me, when I demanded to change the way I felt, and you know, a good friend of mine in Louisville, Billy H., and I talk about this a lot, he and I have decided that we never got in trouble, drunk or sober, except when we were demanding to change the way we feel now. That's at the heart of all of it, is that demand to feel different now. And and for the next 25 years after that first drunk, when I wanted to feel different, it didn't matter what it cost, and it didn't matter who it cost. That was right at the heart of my powerlessness over alcohol. And I'm not going to talk much about my drunkalogue tonight. It was about 25 years from that first drunk until the time I got sober. But just to tell you a little about it, I'm pretty confident that I went to bed drunk at least 80% of the nights in that 25 years. It wasn't something I did sometimes. I was not a binge drinker. Alcohol was the absolute center of my life for 25 years. You either had to accept the way I drank and the way I lived, or you had to get out of my life, and a lot of people had to leave. Everybody eventually had to leave my life, and a lot of people that a part of me didn't want to leave had to leave. school was easy for me. By the time I was 16, I'd gotten in enough mess, or at least felt like I had, on account of my drinking, that I felt like I had to leave that farming community where I grew up. So I took a Greyhound bus 200 miles to Louisville. I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville, and they gave me a bunch of tests and let me in as an early admission student. And over the next 8 years, I drank and worked my way through undergraduate and law school, and that's all just a blur. I graduated from law school in the spring of 1968, and my daughter, who was my only child for over 20 years, was born that same spring. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for 10 years from 1968 to 1978 with a fair degree of material success. That's real hard for me to be objective about, because the first few years I was sober, I couldn't have been more honest. I had been just fabulously successful during those 10 years. And if I live and stay sober 30 years, I may have been a total failure. I don't really know. But best I can do tonight, guys, is moderately successful. And I do know that I had some material things, and that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested there was something wrong with a person who at least a third of the nights in that 10 years didn't make any effort to take off his clothes and go to bed like a normal human being. At least a third of the nights, I just passed out in some circumstance other than taking off my clothes and going to bed like a normal human being. When you suggested that there was something wrong with that, when you suggested there was something wrong with somebody who couldn't have any relationship of any kind in his life. I'm not just talking about boy-girl relationships. I'm talking about any relationship that had any reality to it, much less honesty. When you called my hand on things like that, I'd stick the material things in your face and tell you I was okay and to leave me alone. And during that 10 years, I began to use a lot of things other than the booze, but during that 10 years, they were all sideshows to the booze. The booze was the big tent. There were things to change the effect of the booze, to increase the effect, to decrease the effect, to help me try to function on the hangovers, but just like it was with Bill and Dr. Bob, those things were sideshows. February 10th of 1978, I'd been practicing law about 10 years, and I was still holding on to that world by my fingernails. Was a Friday. I wound up full of scotch, cocaine, quaaludes, speed, and vodka. And I wound up driving a Corvette off the road at about 130 miles an hour. I did an awful lot of bad things to my body. I broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg, and had to do a bypass in the upper leg and take out a vein to replace that. And it separated my pelvis and snapped my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. Had a suprapubic catheter, and that's just where they bore a hole in your belly and slap this plastic tube into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And I was in the hospital for about 6 months out of the first year after that wreck and had a half dozen major surgeries that first year. The doctors told me early on that I would probably never walk again without at least braces on both legs and one or two canes, and that they doubted very seriously that we could find a surgeon anywhere that would attempt to put my plumbing back together so I would ever have urinary function again. Well, just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, because I didn't follow directions then any better than I ever did, and that's not very good at all. I always had a problem with the directions. You see, I'm smarter than the people that make the directions. Know more about it, and the people that are making the directions are making the directions for stone idiots. You know, if it says don't exceed 6 in 24 hours, obviously that means about 36. You know, I have to kind of interpolate. So I'm usually better off if I don't look at the directions, and that's worked out fairly well because I've done a lot of that. But at any rate, purely by the grace of God, I've been sober 19 and a half years, and I haven't owned a bracer or a cane for about 20 and a half years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function, but I didn't know that was going to happen. And my reaction to that prognosis is that I would lay in my hospital bed and have my friends bring me in booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And I would say really intelligent things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough, but it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And I'd explain to them that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he wasn't prepared to do the time, and they weren't going to hear me whining and give me another drink. And that's real insanity, and it's real powerlessness, and it's right where I was. I didn't go broke right away after that wreck because a little law firm had built up around this other guy and myself, so some money kept coming in. And at the time of the wreck, I was remarried to my daughter's mama. And I'm not going to go through a blow-by-blow of my marital and relationship history tonight, and I'm not proud of it, but I'm also not going to insert humor into things that I did that were funny on my part. There have been an awful lot of amends that have had to be made on account of it, but I will just make this comment. You know, I said I was remarried to my daughter's mama. Nobody ever does that but us. Not ever. Not ever. We do it both drunk and sober, and there may be a pretty good reason for it, because we change so drastically in sobriety sometimes that we are truly different people. But now, the next time you see somebody doing that, you look, and I will guarantee you that at least one, and frequently both, is alcoholic, dope fiend, or so Al-Anon sick they cannot crawl. If a normie even thought about jumping back into a frying pan they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum trying to get back in it. But it's just business as usual for us. But at any rate, I was remarried to my daughter's mom, and it wasn't she that I'd had with me when I had the wreck. I had another young lady with me, and my daughter's mother and I had finally divorced during that year, and I'd wound up married to that lady who was hurt, but not nearly as badly as I was. And by about a year after that wreck, sometime around the first of the year of 1979, I was ready for my first trip to the asylum. Now, I don't use the word asylum to be cute. Bill Wilson uses that word, and my mama used that word. Seemed like when I was a kid, folks didn't have breakdowns and go to the hospital. They went crazy and got put in asylums. And that's far more descriptive of what kept happening to me, I assure you. So I made my first trip, and by that time, the phenomenon of craving that the big book talks about, and the phenomenon of craving, there's nothing mysterious about that at all. All in the world that is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And the book makes it clear that every alcoholic will develop it if we drink long enough, and here's the man blower, a non-alky can't drink enough to develop the phenomenon of craving. Well, I had it first drink I ever took. All those years, my fear that if I drank around the clock, you'd see what I was and wasn't, and I'd have to face what I was and wasn't, was usually a little greater than the need to drink when I'd wake up in the morning. Nobody ever had to tell me that drinking in the morning would cure a hangover. I was born knowing that somewhere in the marrow of my bones. But for all those years, the fear was usually a little greater than the physical need. But by about a year after that wreck, the scales had tipped on that, and the phenomenon of craving had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking, I had just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop myself from drinking. Once I got alcohol in my system, usually something from outside had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And when it did intervene and get me prized loose, it was 3 or 4 days before I was physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me in that first asylum, and they got me through the 3 or 4 days, and they set me up in a chair, and of all things, had an AA meeting. I can't imagine why they thought I ought to have an AA meeting. And they read how it works, and said they got step 3, and read, made a decision to turn our willing lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Well, that offended my intellect. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And I hobbled on over to the telephone and called somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Now, that was sometime around the first of the year of 1979, and I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81. And I really don't remember much that happened in that 2.5 years. But some of the things that I do know that happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie, and I'm real grateful for that, because that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded, and I proved that I wasn't going to hit bottom, that I wasn't going to make that decision. You know, hitting bottom used to be such a mystery to me. The first few years I was sober, I would look around and I'd see folks coming in the program that hadn't lost families and hadn't lost jobs and businesses, and obviously they'd hit bottom. They'd get sober and do just fine. And I'd see other poor guys that were more like me, that were losing bodily functions, were going back to the penitentiary for the 5th or 6th time, all on account of booze and dope, people dying all around them, and it seemed like they weren't even slowing down. So it was such a mystery, but it's not a mystery to me anymore. And part of it was learning what a decision is. You know, I didn't know the difference between an intention and a decision. And for me in my life today, until I act on it, it's just an intention. Don't let me tell you I've made a decision to do something unless I've begun to take action on it. You call my hand, tell me it's just an intention. But I know now what bottom is for me, and I guess for most folks. It's a decision that I'll do anything. I'll do anything to keep from living the way I've been living and feeling the way I've been feeling. And once I get there, I've hit bottom, regardless of what it is I'm hitting bottom on. And until I get there, it doesn't make any difference what happens out there. I hadn't hit bottom. And I proved that I wasn't going to hit bottom as long as I had a Timex watch. I sure wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. The state of Kentucky helped me out a little further by jerking my law license right after that. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity during that period, and she was staying with some girlfriends and dad in an accident. I last laid eyes on my daughter in January of 1980. I didn't see or talk to her again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my interest in the office building that we built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was all gone. And after all the material things were gone, my daddy was on the farm in his late 80s with nothing but his Social Security, and I went down and stole that to keep on drinking on. And I've got a much older, badly crippled sister, and I endangered her health and her life by using her and abusing her to keep on with my drinking and drugging. I burned every bridge, And for almost a year and a half, up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address. I lived on the street and on an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that year and a half with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And the way that happened seems real clear to me today. You see, a good half of those 18 places I was in had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, a lot of times, between trips to the asylum, if I was able, I would go to an awful lot of AA meetings between trips to the asylum. So I had a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it's one of my frequent and sincere prayers today, and this is not a joke. It always gets a laugh, but I'm not joking. It's one of my frequent and sincere prayers that I don't ever know as much about Alcoholics Anonymous as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that with all my heart. And what would happen during that year and a half is that one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain would go, yes, I know it works for you guys, and I'm so glad it does, but y'all don't understand how complex and complicated I really am. You know, y'all don't understand this terrible and magnificent complexity that's my real problem. Of course I know I'm an alcoholic, and for that matter a dope fiend too, but don't you understand those are just little results or symptoms of this terrible and magnificent complexity, and y'all didn't understand what a broad stage I'd played on, and my God, my tentacles had just touched so many, and y'all didn't understand that I saw things more clearly than ordinary people, and I felt them so much more acutely, Lord, I was just wounded by my own understanding, don't you know? And I couldn't go along with y'all's little myth of a higher power and compulsively go to your little meetings and not drink and expect this terrible and magnificent complexity to go away, and by that time I'd probably get a tear in my eye, so grateful it would work for you simple-minded folk, but it couldn't work for me in my magnificence. Very next heartbeat. Without missing a stitch, one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life, and my brain would go, yeah, I know it works for you guys, and I'm glad. But you guys don't know about the parts of me that are missing and always have been. Y'all don't know that I've never been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself, not really. And you don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my entire life. And you don't know that anything in my life that looks like it was good or even okay is some kind of house of cards and a pack of lies. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and people and things left to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. I've absolutely destroyed everything. I've gone too far past the point of no return. There's nothing left for me to get sober with and there's nothing left for me to get sober for. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Very next heartbeat, it'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I'm so magnificent and I'm believing it both times. You know, I don't know this thing wrong. The fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of an asylum in Nashville, Tennessee. And they let me in because they didn't think I'd live another week if they left me on the street. And I stayed in there about 30 days until it was time to kick me out. And my roommate's family, who lived there in Nashville, felt sorry for me and said, Don, of course, I had no place to go, had no home, had no car, had nothing. Why don't you come and stay with us a few days and let's try to figure out what to do with you? So I went and lived with them a year on charity. And for the first 6 months, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe I had to get better in my case before I could truly grab hold of recovery. During that 6 months, I went to an awful lot of meetings, most of them at the clubhouse there in Nashville, the 202 Club. A lot of you have been there and know about it. And I got to where I could go 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped on something, and that was a world record for me. From the first time I'd gotten drunk, I'd never been that long without getting messed up in or out of an asylum. And how I really know I got better is they only put me back in one rubber room in that whole 6 months. At the rate I'd been going, I would have been delighted to settle for twice a year in the asylum. I would have thought it was the picture of mental health. Well, in early March of 81, I finally got up enough nerve after a year. Here I am destitute, living on the streets, and knowing for a year that if I would send a letter back into Louisville with a return address, that an insurance company would send me a little check on account of my wife's death. And my fear of Louisville was so great that it took me a year to get up the nerve to send that letter back there. And I want to tell you very honestly, standing up here tonight, I don't believe there was any paranoia in that. I believe the messes I had made and what I had done to people and all the things that I had done, that I didn't have any business sending a letter back into Louisville with the return address. I believe a loving God's gone back and poured oil on the troubled waters of my past to keep the worst of what I feared from happening. But in early March of 81, I got up the nerve. I sent the letter. They sent the check. Got there in late March of 81, and I got drunk. And I was deep in what I call my pop-off vodka slash Listerine stage of drinking, and I have truly drunk a barrel of both of them. And the truth is, I've got better memories of the Listerine than I do that old hot pop-off. Not just because you could get it 24 hours a day, it actually tasted a little better and would get you just as drunk. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking plenty of both of them, and by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, the last day I drank, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, and loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks I was sober, I didn't have any idea there was any such thing as a loving God or that anything was giving me any gifts. And this is real important to me because I couldn't have gotten sober without it. Because, you see, coming off that drunk in April of 81, my most recent drunk, did not feel a bit different than the 200 before that. If I'd kept waiting to see a burning bush, if I'd kept waiting to feel like Alcoholics Anonymous could take care of all that magnificent and terrible complexity that I thought was my trouble, if I'd kept waiting to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous would work, to start blindly doing what you guys in this big book told me to do, I know for an absolute fact that I'd be rotting in a pauper's grave somewhere around Nashville for over 19 years. The biggest gift that my loving God gave me was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they'd work, and I sure didn't want to do them. And I had no idea that I had that gift or any other gift. And after 3 or 4 days, when I had shaken to the point that I could stumble, I stumbled back to the door of the 202 Club there in Nashville, and I didn't think they would let me in. And tell you the truth, they shouldn't have let me in. They knew me very well. They knew me because I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They knew me because they'd caught me shooting dope in their men's room. They knew me because they had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through there, and a big old tall boy, about 6'6", by the name of Joe W., who's still around, walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." Now, I had been around for over 2 years, and I thought Joe was giving me a compliment. I really did. My knee-jerk reaction was, "Well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with here." But he went on, and he said, "And you know, Don, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all the time." And something about that stuck inside me, and it was still stuck there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door. And I had my Siamese twin. My Siamese twin for the last 2 or 3 years of my drinking was pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Just absolutely pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And they let me in, and I said, "Will you tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live?" And they said, "Don, we'll be glad to, because it's keeping us sober." They said, "Don't drink, don't take dope, and go to meetings." By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, let me assure you that during that 60 days, it was clear to me that it wasn't necessary for me to go to all those meetings. It was still clear to me a lot of the times that you guys were religious fanatics. My brain was still regularly assuring me that what I needed to do was get my head out of the sand, get my butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, get a good-looking woman, big car, for God's sake, be somebody. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had of being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another, and we don't have to do but go to these dumb old meetings, so that's what we're going to do." And guess what? Your dumb old meetings worked just as well as if I had thought they were exactly what I needed. I had it all backwards. I thought in order for AA to work, it had to feel like it was working. I had to believe it was working. Truth is, I thought I had to be able to see the causal relationship between this cause and that. Didn't have a thing to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul finally get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind my raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. I said, "But I've read the big book 3 or 4 times. They said, "Don, we know. You've been criticizing the literary style and quoting it to us while you've been dying, dummy." They said, "If you want to live, you've got to get that turned around exactly the opposite, too." Said, "You've got it in your head that this big book is a philosophy book." and there's something in there that you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. I said, partner, it's not going to work that way. He said, there's not a thing in that book you can learn that will keep you sober for a heartbeat. Because this deal of sobriety is not a learning process, they told me. It is a doing process. And they said, in your case, you have had enough information about Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober the rest of your life with no more information about Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, what's killing you isn't what you know and don't know. What's killing you is what you're doing and not doing. This deal of sobriety, they said, is a doing process, and this big book is not a philosophy book. It is a simple instruction manual for your actions. And they said, while there's nothing in this book you can learn that'll keep you sober for a heartbeat, if you will do what it says, if you will take the actions that are suggested in there, if you will do those first 9 steps the way this book says do them in order to reach a state of recovery, and having done that, if you will live on 10, 11, and 12 every day of your life the way this book says live on them, in order to maintain your spiritual condition and get your daily reprieve, you'll be able to live comfortably without a drink a day at a time indefinitely, and on top of that, you're going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. So they said, if you want to live, you better pick up that book and act like you've never laid eyes on it, and start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part, and not interpreting one single thing, and not looking for anything to learn but for what it says do. So over my brain's veto, I started doing that and started going through the steps. And guess what? Those steps worked just like they said. They told me that the steps worked on alcoholism like penicillin works on an infection. They explained to me that the steps are the only program of recovery, that I can't go to enough meetings to be in the program of recovery or even the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the steps are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you'd be a full-fledged member of this fellowship on any day you got a desire to stop drinking, sport. Said they even took the honest out of it for people like you. But there's a whole lot of difference, they told me, in between the fellowship and the program. They said, you can latch onto this fellowship like a leech without doing no steps, and you may stay dry a week, and you may stay dry 30 years. But if you do it that way, you'll have absolutely no healing of what's really wrong, of that disordered ego, of that dis-ease, of that inability to be comfortable inside yourself, except just exactly as you do these steps. And that's when they told me that the steps work on alcoholism like penicillin works on an infection. They said, Don, if you've got an infection that's going to kill you if you don't do something about it but will respond to penicillin, they said, you don't have to understand what your infection is. Said, you don't even have to be intellectually convinced that that infection is causing all those terrible things wrong with magnificent you. And he said, you don't need to know or understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. Said, in fact, Don, you don't even have to believe that those penicillin tablets will take care of what's wrong with you. And you don't even have to want to take the fat tablets. They said, if you've got the infection and you take the tablets as directed, and they underscored that very strongly, you'll get just fine, thank you. And they said, these steps work on alcoholism the same way. Said, they're not here for you to agree with or disagree with, for you to want to do or not want to do, to memorize or not memorize. They're here for you to do if you want to live with this thing called alcoholism. And it's worked just that way in my life. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and ask a power greater than myself to get through without drinking and drugging, and get on my knees at night and thank that power. And the tears came to my eyes, because I had tried so hard. You see, from the first time that I saw you guys, it was clear to me that if I was going to get this thing, and I had a suspicion from the first time I got here that it was the only shot I had to live it. I had a suspicion that if I was going to get it, that I had to somehow make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing the way it looked like to me you thought, felt, and believed. And I had tried every way I knew to change my insides, to make myself start thinking and feeling and believing the way it looked like to me you did, and I couldn't change anything. So when they suggested that praying, I'm sitting there crying, explaining that to them, and how the second step is killing me, and I finally heard them when they said, Don, you've got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And my mouth fell open, because you see, that's at the heart of my illness, that insane conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. Lord, we can't have little Donnie doing something he doesn't feel like doing. It's just not right, you know. And they said, well, no, Don, we would never suggest that. Said, in the first place, you are far too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. And they said, in the second place, your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs are your illness. And in the third place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do, what you think, feel, or believe won't have a thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and you start saying those words and don't worry about what's going through your brain because that won't count. Well, over my brain's loud veto, by the grace of God, in April of 1981, I started getting on my knees every morning and every night and asking and thanking my higher power that I didn't even think was there for me. And somewhere along the line, the miracle of the second step began to happen, and I began to come to believe. And as far as I know, except for when I've been in the hospital and somebody's knelt down by my bed and held my hand, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 1981. And that's the second most important thing in my sobriety. And I'm not telling you that to tell you how good I am. I'm telling you that for a far different reason. I want to tell you that I have never been able to do anything on the spirituality of our program except stumble a couple of steps in the right direction, get knocked on my butt by self-will, forget for a moment that I ever did a third step, that I ever did a sixth or seventh step, or that there's any such thing as an 11th step I'm supposed to be living on. And then remember it and say, oops, Mom, Dad, I failed up again, excuse me. Stumble another couple of steps in the right direction, get knocked on my butt again, and get up and do the same thing over. And I want to tell you that here at 19 and a half years sober, there are a lot of days when I go through that process more than 100 times. And I used to think that every one of those things was an interruption of my spiritual growth. But I've come to the conclusion that those things are the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. My God, it turns out, doesn't require perfection. He or she doesn't even require consistency, apparently. My God seems to be tickled to death with persistence. Just keeping on stumbling in that right direction. Keeping on starting over. And back to the praying. That is the one thing that I have done every morning and every night. But I want to tell you that at least half the mornings and nights and all those thousands of mornings and nights, it has been clear that I either have not felt like doing that or have not had time to do that. A big percentage of the time, I've been so scared and or obsessed by something that it seemed like I couldn't remember the last word I just tried to pray. And a pretty good bit of the time, it's been absolutely clear to me that those words were bouncing off the walls and ceiling and it couldn't possibly be doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning. And I've gotten down there every night, and something has worked every single day. And with God's help, I'm not going to stop it tonight, and I'm not going to stop it in the morning, because you see, I'm not telling you that you can't stay sober without getting on your knees morning and night. A lot of people I know do. But what I am telling you is I have absolutely no experience to share with you about how to do that, because I have been absolutely unable to stay sober without getting on my knees every morning and every night. I said it's the second most important thing in my sobriety. The most important thing in my sobriety is real simple, and that is today, just for today, with God's help and yours, I'm not going to drink or take dope even if my butt falls off. Because, you see, I had to get it straight that powerless over alcohol did not mean powerless over my elbow before I could live. For a long time, I thought, well, I'm powerless over alcohol, and little Donnie wants to drink so bad, so this AA thing's not working for me. The bad news was that I had to do the first mature things I'd ever done in my life. I had to get it through my head that neither you guys nor this higher power you were talking about were going to knock a drink out of my hand. That I was going to have to, for a while, not do some things that I really wanted to do and do some things that I really didn't want to do. Now, for anybody that's new, the good news is that about 60 days, the spirituality took over, and I haven't wanted to drink or drug a single day in the last 19 years plus, but I would never have lived to have gotten there if I hadn't have had that enlightenment that I wasn't powerless over my elbow and I could not abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. That God wouldn't take it and you guys wouldn't take it. But at any rate, they led me through the first 9 steps in Nashville, and Cherry Carpenter, who was my sponsor, like never got it through my head that the third step was only a decision. I thought it was a Cecil B. DeMille movie of me turning my will and life over to God, and he finally explained to me, he said, Don, this is so hard for me, but I'm going to try to get up on your intellectual level. He said, let's suppose there are 3 frogs sitting on a log, one decides to jump in the pond, how many are left? And I said, 2, and he said, no, dumbass, 3. He just decided, he hadn't gone anywhere. So I still knew where the complexity was, and I said, okay, you win the semantic argument, Cherry, but it was intellectually insulting that my third step was that simple, you know. Once I have decided to do that, how do I implement the decision? She said, that's just as simple. She said, all you're deciding to do is the rest of the steps, and to try to do the next right thing instead of what you want to do. Says, if you do that, you won't have to worry about what your will in life is supposed to be, because God will make your will in life what God would have it be. And over the years, I found out that that's right. Cherry sponsored me through a fourth step and a fifth step, and I did that and formed a picture of what a spiritual don ought to look like. You know, he told me after my third step that my third step wouldn't amount to anything unless I did a fourth step at once, because that's what the book said. And sure enough, at once, 8 months later, I did that fourth step. So I got this picture of what a spiritual don ought to look like, and I blew through steps 6 and 7, and it was clear to me that 6 and 7 were where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I had decided I ought to be when I did my fourth and fifth step. I got into my 8th and 9th step, and at about a year and a half sober, as a byproduct of my 8th and 9th steps, my law license got put back in order. And in January 1983, when I was 21 months sober, scared to death, I went back to Louisville. I was never able to get a minimum wage job in Nashville. When I celebrated a year sober, I was living in an attic with no phone, no car, teeth finishing rotting out of my head, happier than I'd ever been in my life. But I got back to Louisville in January 83, scared to death, and threw myself into AA in Louisville. Didn't think it would work. Was sure it wouldn't, but I didn't have any other choice except to go to those dumb old Louisville AA meetings, and it worked just fine, thank you. Second month I was in town, by God incidents, I wound up talking at the Kentucky State Convention. People started saying nice things to me. Gee, will you talk here, Don? Will you be my sponsor? And started making some money right away. First thing you know, I'm driving a nice car and wearing nice clothes. Same month I talked at that conference, saw my daughter for the first time in over 3 years. And 2 months later, she moved in with me, living with me all through high school. And she's a 32-year-old successful artist living in Utah now. In fact, I'm having to leave the conference early because she's unexpectedly going to be in Louisville this weekend. And she's been in Al-Anon for many years. And she and I talk a couple of times a week, and we talk about God and higher power and that sort of thing. And to let you know the reality of it, we can still get on one another's nerves bad enough to make the other one break out in hives, but that's okay too. That's okay too. It's so much more beautiful than I ever dreamt it could be. So all those things were going great. Throughout my whole sobriety, I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week, and I've tried to do what people asked me to do. So all those things were going so great. And I want to tell you that the first 9 years of my sobriety were just, they were like a fairy tale. They were magical. It was wonderful. But relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me the first 9 years I was sober. And my God, did I work on relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos. I didn't have any bad intentions. I wanted to be like this spiritual don that I'd formed a picture of when I'd done that fourth and fifth step, and whatever character defect was embarrassing me and making my self-centered little butt uncomfortable and inconsistent with my little idea of what a spiritual don ought to be, I'd grab that sucker by the collar. I'd work on it with steps, prayer, sponsors, meetings, outside counseling, rigorous honesty. I'd grab it by the collar, slam it up against the wall, say, come here, God, give me a little help. We'll get rid of this thing. And God never seemed the least bit interested. For 9 years, relationships with opposite sex and financial chaos got worse every week. And in May of 1990, I'm going to make it brief because I'm going to sit down here in a sec, but I'm not going to go through all of it, but Cherry had died about a year before that, and I wound up with an additional sponsor up in Cleveland, Tom B., and I spent a weekend in Cleveland with Tom, and he'd been sober 29 years at that time. And there was an AA golf tournament for the Cleveland Akron AAs that took place in Cleveland that weekend, and those old boys treated Tom like a newcomer. There was one old boy there that weekend who had drank with Dr. Bob, and he brought several to pick me up at the airport. And before we got out of the airport, one of them had said, "Oh, sober about 6 or 7 years, that's about 9 or 10 years, that's about the time most folks begin to look at steps 6 and 7. And I thought, well, you know, I've listened to over 50 fifth steps, and I've talked all over this country. You don't know who you're talking to. By the time I left there that weekend, I realized that I had missed just about everything that a human being could miss. Or I'd begun to realize it. I didn't realize it all that weekend. It was a process. You see, 6 and 7 turned out not to be where I went to work on me to make me into what I had decided I was supposed to be, so I could be comfortable and I could not be embarrassed. 6 and 7 turned out to be just what the 7th step prayer says. 6 and 7 turned out to be where I stopped working on me and where I laid all of me at my God's feet and said, Mom, Dad, I give up. My problem with perfection is not my inability to attain it. My problem with perfection is my inability to recognize it. And I'm asking you to remove the character defects that you want to remove that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, and I don't know which ones they are. I can look back now and see that those character defects persist in so long in sobriety, frustrating me so badly and putting me in so much pain. And it seemed at the time that that could have absolutely no use, that that's the reason that I've got something to give in Alcoholics Anonymous. 75% of the time that my phone rings and somebody asks me for something in Alcoholics Anonymous, they want what I've got because those character defects stayed with me so deep and long and painfully in sobriety, and I somehow was able not to drink and get to a little better place in it. You know, both the Big Book and the 12 and 12 quote a piece of non-conference literature. They say that of myself I'm nothing, the Father does the work. Well, for 9 years, my brain edited that to read, of myself, I'm not enough, and I have to have some help from God, and that's not what it says. It says, of myself, I'm nothing. The Father does the work. So I came back to Louisville, and I began the process of started stumbling in that direction, of leaving the pattern up to God and just trying to listen real close and take that next stitch, because stitching's my job. I never get any glimpse of God's will except in the right now. If I'm talking to you about God's will 5 minutes from now or 5 days or 5 years from now, don't pay any attention to me. I'm squirrel caging. Because the only picture of God's will that my higher power ever gives me is in the right now, where to take that next stitch. He or she doesn't ever discuss the pattern with me. Apparently, they think the pattern doesn't have anything to do with me. So I came back to Louisville and started stumbling in that direction, and I've been stumbling that way for a little over 10 years now. I'm going to close by telling you this, and this is not something that I've made up for dramatic effect. Please believe me, it's the gospel truth. Here's how well that has worked in the last 10 years. If in May of 1990, when I was 9 years sober, if my God had said, Don, I'm sick of that whining, and there's a pencil and a piece of paper, I want you to make a list of everything you want in your life, of what you want in your relationship with the opposite sex, of what you want in your financial life, of what you want in your life in AA, of your law practice, and the house you live in, the cars you drive, and on down the line. And I had made that list, and I had given it to God. And God had said, here, St. Pete, make sure he gets it. I'm tired of that mouth. And I had gotten everything that I truly thought was the best that was possible for me in May of 1990. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to come as a little child, when I'm willing to let go of that self-determined objective that I've dressed up in spiritual clothes and decided it's not a self-determined objective just because I put it in spiritual clothes, when I'm willing to say, Mom, Dad, I don't know, but I'm going to take your hand and I'm going to try to take that next stitch. My God has got things in store for me that are more beautiful than anything I can imagine for myself. Anybody that's new, if I haven't gotten across to you that being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is more fun than you can possibly imagine, I haven't done my job. Because I lived my whole life in fear of being bored until I got sober. I'd get ripped on Tuesday afraid I was going to be bored on Thursday. And living without booze and dope looked so boring to me that I consciously chose to die many times rather than to try to live that way. And I haven't been bored for one single heartbeat since April of 1981. Most wonderful way of life available. Thank all of you, and I hope we all have a great conference.